Let us start. Next talk, next speaker is Alessandro Dadda. He's going to talk about new results in lattice supersymmetry.
Well, thanks to the organizers, first of all, to be able to talk here, which is a double pleasure, because it's a pleasure to talk to Ricardo's fest. Ricardo has been one of my collaborators at the very, very beginning of my career, so we spent a very many long time discussing physics in the barracks of the Institute. The other reason why I'm glad to talk today is because I can take this chance, and I think it's a very good way to for this celebration, to talk about something new, in the sense that it's something that is not appeared even on the archive, so something no one has heard about, except us, of course. It's part of a program, a collaboration that has been going on for many years. Here you see the people who are involved in the present paper, but there have been other people involved through the years. This collaboration started in 2003, and it's a sort of an Italian-Japanese collaboration, and it's on lattice supersymmetry. And we did some very good things at the beginning. Then we struggled along for some time, but I think that now we made another step forward, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So I'll start my talk giving just the very essential of the things that we did in the past, only the strict necessary for you to understand what has come after. And as a first thing, well, why is supersymmetry difficult when you are on a lattice? Well, it's difficult because Poincaré invariance is broken on the lattice. And normally one doesn't worry about Poincaré invariance being broken because when you take the continuum limit, it's recovered. And so no one worries about. But for supersymmetry, it's a different story because in general, you have relevant operators on the lattice that break supersymmetry. And so you need often fine-tuning to recover supersymmetry when you take the continuum limit. And that's why having exact supersymmetry on the lattice would be an important step. But I might add that would be also an important step maybe to understand supersymmetry itself. So, well, going a bit more into the detail, one reason why supersymmetry is difficult to put on the lattice is that on the lattice, derivatives are replaced by finite differences. And so you see that what in the continuum is a commutator, on the lattice becomes a kind of shifted commutator. Where the argument of the field here is shifted by essentially by the lattice generators. So this n mu are the shifts that generate the whole lattice. So the conventional Leibniz rule is replaced by a modified Leibniz rule, and that's always a problem when you have a symmetry. Once the Leibniz rule goes, everything goes more or less. But then there is a third reason why supersymmetry is problematic on the lattice, and that is that there is the problem of the chiral fermions on the lattice. So when you try to put fermions on the lattice, you have the phenomenon of the doubling. So essentially, you have species doublings for the fermions, and so in the end, the number of bosons and the number of fermions are different. And then, of course, supersymmetry is broken. So these are, this is a point that I'm going to talk about because it's one of the points we address in this recent developments. So here is a very sketchy history of some of the attempts that have been made. The people have been trying to preserve at least one supersymmetry charge on the lattice, because one supersymmetry charge is often enough to protect the theory from developing operators which are relevant and break supersymmetry when you take the continuum limit. Basically, there are two methods. Well, there are more than two, but these are the sort of the main ones, and they are also very closely related together in the end. One is called the orbifold method, which was developed by David Kaplan, Mittat Hunsal, and other people. And where the idea is essentially that you start from a supersymmetric matrix model. It's a sort of a huge matrix model with no lattice, but you generate the lattice by some orbifold condition. And if in generating the lattice you succeed to preserve some of this original supersymmetry, then what you get is a lattice theory with one supersymmetry, where one supersymmetry is all you manage to do in with this method. So this is one method, and it was applied also to gauge theories, but the limit is in fact that only one supersymmetry is preserved at most. Another method called the twisted field methods. Essentially, the idea is that we reformulate the theory in using twisted fermions. Twisted fermions means what is written down here, that you treat the spinorial index and the internal index of the extended supersymmetry as indices of a global group. And then when you do this expansion, you see you get in this new group, you get the scalar and the vector and the tensor and so on. And the result is, in both methods, really what they have in common is that the original supersymmetry algebra is replaced by a twisted algebra. And in this twisted algebra, there is a scalar charge, Q, which is nilpotent. And this is the charge that is exactly preserved on the lattice. Of course, one criticism of this is that it's true that you succeed to preserve one charge, one supersymmetry charge on the lattice, but this one charge that being nilpotent is completely disconnected from the translation part of the group. So in a way, you are selecting a subalgebra which is completely unrelated to the translation, and that's the one that you put exactly on the lattice. Now here we came a few years ago, and these are all the people that have been at one time or another involved in this project. And our attitude has been from the beginning all or nothing. So we want all supersymmetries on the lattice. So we are not happy just with F1. And so that was our program. And the method we used is based essentially with two ingredients. One is the twisted algebra, like I explained before, and the Dirac-Kähler fermions and so on. But then what characterizes the method, our methods, in a more specific way, is that we start from the usual hypercubic lattice, but then we extend this lattice by introducing extra links. In a way that the supersymmetry charges are related to the extra links that have been introduced, in the same way as the links of the ordinary lattice are related to translations. So we have extended lattices in the end. And the extra link arises by requiring that all charges in the superalgebra follow modified line rule in the same way as for translations. So and this is essentially a scheme of what happens. When you have translations, you have a modified Leibniz rule, so the commutator is turned into a shifted commutator, and we assume that for supersymmetry charges, the same thing happens. So we introduce these extra shifts, which are called A, small a. But of course, these extra shifts are not arbitrary, because you have consistency relations that come from the original algebraic structure of the supersymmetric theory. And so if you have an anticommutator of two supersymmetry charges that is zero, then this doesn't give any constraint. But if you have an anticommutator that gives a translation, then this gives a corresponding relation for the shifts.
Should you not shift theta?
Sorry?
Should you not shift theta also?
No, theta is not shifted in this scheme. And so the new lattice is generated now both by the usual translations, but also by these extra shifts. And so what you get in the end is not just one hypercubic lattice, but a set of hypercubic lattices connected by these other shifts. And these other shifts are not random, but they are heavily constrained by the algebra. So they are so heavily constrained that it's not always possible to apply this scheme. And because you see that in order to apply this scheme is crucial also to make a very specific choice in the base of the supersymmetry algebra. It's not the same to use a certain set of supersymmetry charges or a linear combination of them. So first you need to choose a very specific set of supersymmetry charges, essentially one that maximizes the number of vanishing anticommutators, because any anticommutator, non-trivial anticommutator, brings a condition. So you want to have as little condition as you can. And so in the end of the story, the cases where it's possible to satisfy these constraints are limited, and this is a list of the ones we have found. So as you see, there is the n equal 4 in four dimensions, but today we'll mainly talk about the n equal 2 in one dimension and the n equal 2 in two dimensions. So, and this is just to show you how it works in one case. This is the supersymmetry algebra n equal 2, dimension, and then you see that the base you need to use to apply this method is again the twisted base, so the one where you treat the spinorial index and the internal supersymmetry index of the charge as rotational index of a group of simultaneous rotation of Lorentz and R symmetry, and you expand in gamma functions. And then the algebra becomes this one that is written, and all the other anticommutators are vanishing. And then the twisted algebra can be discretized, and there is a solution for these shifts. A solution that actually has some arbitrariness, because you have four shifts, because you have four supersymmetry charges, you get three conditions from three independent conditions from the algebra. So one, which I called A here, is arbitrary. And so you have many, many possibilities. And one possibility is, which is I call the asymmetric choice, is to minimize the number of sides of the lattice. And that you can do by choosing A equals 0, because then the lattice doesn't change, because the A link, the fermionic link, just connects points of the old lattice. But in this way, you spoiled whatever was left of the Lorentz invariance, of course. The other situation is to keep whatever you can of the Lorentz invariance, so rotations of pi over 2. But then this is the solution. And then the lattice becomes extended, becomes a lattice made of the original lattice plus the dual lattice. Yeah, but there is a connection which I would like to explore with the roots.
Yeah.
In fact, that's something
other.
In the picture looks like, but I believe that there is a connection between these solutions and some root system. But that's something we never really investigated. And now this is the sort of this is what we did in the past, and now I'm trying to come to what we did in the latest 2-3 months. Well, in the past we did a lot more, but this is what you need to know to follow. So, what's summing up? What has happened? We have introduced this extended lattice. And these extended lattices are made essentially by a certain number of copies of the standard hypercubic lattice. And these copies are connected by these extra links that are related to the supersymmetry charges. So in the case of n equal 2, d equal 2, the extended lattice is the cubic lattice plus the dual lattice. So two copies. Now, the translations on the lattice only make you move on an hypercubic lattice. So essentially, the field configurations, which I'm going to call them back there, but don't formalize too much on the word. The field configurations, which are invariant under translations, only need to be constant on each copy of the cubic sublattice of this extended lattice. So if you have an extended lattice made by k copies, then you have k different choices for your translational invariant configuration. On the other hand, the fields, the physical fields that you see in the continuum limit, they are fluctuations around this translational invariant configurations. So in the end, 1 degree of freedom of the lattice corresponds to k degree of freedom in the continuum limit. On the other hand, you have multiplied by k the number of sides, so that's perfectly logical. But of course, as we are dealing with the supersymmetric theory, we will expect that this k physical degree of freedom will be members of the same supermultiplet, because after all, these k copies are connected by supersymmetry charges. And here comes where this could open a possibility for solving the problem of the species doublers. Because, you see, there would be doublers. Now, there is a chance that could be interpreted as fluctuations around a different translational invariant configuration. And so the would-be doublers would be just other members of the same supermultiplet. So there wouldn't be any more unphysical things, but would just be the ingredients that you need to realize supersymmetry. Now, so far we implemented the scheme, and this is what we have done recently, in the very simplest supergravity model, supersymmetry model, which is the simplest quantum supersymmetric quantum mechanical system in one dimension with n equal 2. And there, things seem to be working very well, in fact. So, first, just a quick review of the model. The model has two supersymmetry charges, whose square is a derivative time, if it's supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So the superfield has the expansion. So we have one scalar field, we have two fermions, and one auxiliary field, which is non-propagating. And the action in terms of the superfields is written here, and this is the potential, and this is the action written in terms of the component fields. Now, let's discretize this system. So the derivative is replaced by a finite translation of spacing A. But now you see that each supersymmetry charge has to have associated a shift, but clearly as the square of each of them has to reproduce a shift of A, then each supersymmetry charge is associated with a shift of A over 2. And so the lattice that we need to consider is a lattice with a spacing A over 2, which you have to think of, though, as made of two of the original lattices shifted with respect to each other with an A over 2 shift. So one made with, by the red balls and one by the green balls. Now, in this lattice, you have two configurations invariant under translation. One where which is just constant over the whole lattice, and the other one which is constant, but it sort of flips, the sign flips at each step. In momentum space, this means that one configuration is at momentum zero and the other is momentum 2 pi over A. Because now, with the lattice being having space A over 2, the Brillouin zone is wide as a width of 4 pi over A. And so these two translational invariant configurations are just a 0 and 2 pi over A. So, and this is essentially what a scheme of what is going to happen. And then I'll show it in detail later. As I have two copies of the translational invariant lattice here, then each degree of freedom of the on the lattice will correspond to 2 degrees of freedom in the continuum. So as I have two bosonic fields in the continuum, they are going to be represented by one bosonic field on the lattice, and I have two fermionic fields in the continuum, and so one fermionic field on the lattice. Now, in momentum space, here is a picture of the Brillouin zone. What's going to happen is that the red line and the blue line represent the kinetic term of the field, of the fields. The bosonic field has a double zero at p equals zero, and this is where the field phi will sit. And the field D will sit at 2 pi over A, where the kinetic term is non-vanishing, and so that means it's a non-propagating field. But for the fermions, I have a single zero at P equals zero, but on the lattice, everything is periodic, and that's the reason why normally you need to have doublers, because the function has to vanish somewhere else. But this somewhere else now is the other vacuum, where you have the other fermionic field. So let's see how this is going to work. First of all, I have to write supersymmetry transformations. I have two supersymmetries. This is one, Q1. This is a slightly technical point. I need to introduce a shift of the argument of the fermions with respect to the arguments of the bosons. This is not strictly important because I can always define psi prime of x as equal to psi of x plus a over 4. I mean, I can always do that. But by introducing this notation, equations become much more symmetric and the hermeticity conditions become more natural. So these are the supersymmetry transformations. And I write them in the momentum representation because in this scheme, in the end, the momentum representation will be much more important. And here are the periodicity condition. Because of the A over 4 shift, the fermionic fields are antiperiodic in momentum space. And when you take the commutator of two supersymmetry transformations, you get a translation. Now, that means that this sine AP over 2 is a translation. It is, in fact, a translation in the continuum limit. But that means that on the lattice, this doesn't correspond to what you expect to be a translation, phi x, fx that goes to fx plus a, but it's this object here. So, but in a way, this is also true in the continuum. I mean, when you take the commutator of two supersymmetry transformation in the continuum, you get something which is a translation, but it's a translation of a parameter root square is zero. So it's not a... So here something similar happens. So this will be my definition of translations. But then the invariance under this translation will bring a conservation law for the momentum, which is not the usual conservation law, but is a conservation law with a sign of the functions, which is non-local in coordinate space. So this makes things more complicated, of course. But it reduces to the usual momentum conservation law in the continuum limit. And the other important thing is that the sine of AP over 2 is invariant when P goes to 2 pi over A minus P, which means that a configuration of momentum P and the configuration of momentum 2 pi over A minus P corresponds to two configurations that have the same momentum in the continuum. So I have two values of the momentum on the lattice that corresponds to the same momentum in the continuum, and that was to be expected because each field on the lattice corresponds to two fields in the continuum. And so here is the exact correspondence of the fields on the lattice with the fields on the continuum. Phi p is the scalar field, but phi of 2 pi over a minus p is the auxiliary field. Of course, in order to match the continuum, these fields have to be rescaled by some powers of the lattice constant. And psi p is psi 1, and psi 2 pi over a minus p is psi 2. And then you can write the supersymmetry transformations in terms of components, and those supersymmetry transformation that I wrote in the previous transparency, these ones, written in component fields, are exactly an n equal to supersymmetry transformations. So what about the other supercharge? How can we find it? Well, there is an easy way. The way is in the continuum, you can obtain delta 2 from delta 1 by just replacing psi 1 with psi 2 and psi 2 with minus psi 1. It's a rotation. And it's easy to see that on the lattice, this means to do this replacement on the fermionic field. This replacement involves also a reflection in X in coordinate space. So it's the coordinate space of the extended lattice has not a simple connection with the coordinate space on the continuum. It involves some tricky operation. And then you get the Q2 here, the other supersymmetry transformations. And if you write this supersymmetry transformation in terms of the component fields, you get exactly the other supersymmetry transformation of the n equal 2 supersymmetry in one dimension. So this is the conclusion. The exact n equal 2 supersymmetry algebra is realized exactly on the extended lattice in terms of just one boson and one fermion field. Now, the crucial point is, can we write an action? And the answer is yes. And it's extremely simple, in a way, because you write this expression here in terms of the two fields that you have on the lattice, and you can prove that this is invariant under both, is exactly invariant, so invariant on the lattice, under both supersymmetry transformations, provided you have this sign conservation law. But now you see, this is very, very strange and very appealing in a way, because each term that I wrote here, this term that I wrote here for the action, corresponds to many different terms in the continuum limit, because each field phi that you see written in the continuum limit can be the small phi, the scalar field, or can be the auxiliary field, according to what region of momentum you are. And the psi can be psi 1 or psi 2, according to what region of the momentum you are. And so this term generates essentially all possible terms that you can obtain from a superfield formulation. From here you get both the kinetic term and the mass term, for instance, as I show you in a minute. So this is one thing. There are some technical details which I don't have time to. For instance, this term here, CNP, if you multiply this action by this, this doesn't affect invariance, and this can be used to tune the different coupling constant, essentially. But that's more technical. And of course, the interaction term cannot be written very easily in coordinate space, because the delta function of the conservation law is non-local. And now this is how the kinetic term and the mass term are generated. The sign conservation law can be satisfied either by P1 plus P2 equals 0, or by P1 minus P2 equal minus 2 pi over A. And if you insert this conservation law in the previous action, in here with n equal 2, then in one case you get the kinetic term, and in the other case you get the mass term, which from the point of view of a superfield formulation look completely different instead. And in fact, you see this is how the kinetic term appears in the end, and this is how the mass term appears. But they both come from the same action. And unlike the interaction terms, the kinetic term and the mass term can also be expressed by some local expression in coordinate space, because the sign conservation law for n equal 2 is reduced to just the ordinary conservation law. Well, this is about the interaction. There isn't much to say here, except that, as I already explained before, that each term of this action corresponds to many different terms in the superfield expansion. For instance, an interaction phi to the fourth and an interaction d1 phi, d2 phi, phi square, they both come from there. And also you get many more things that disappear in the continuum limit because they have non-canonical dimensions. And finally, this is the conclusion. There is a lot more, which I don't have time to explain, of course. The conclusion is that the theory has a full n equal 2 supersymmetry on the lattice, including interaction, which is non-trivial. Of course, on the lattice, you don't have any ultraviolet divergence because everything is regularized. And the great risk in general would be that you have, when you start doing loop calculations, that you have contributions of species doublers that break everything. But here you don't have species doublers because the species doublers are the other members of the supermultiplet. And just to be sure, we made some explicit checks on supersymmetric worded entities, and they're all fulfilled. The continuum limit can be taken. You just rescale all the fields, rescale the coupling constant in the suitable way, and they are smooth. And of course, as I said, there are no doublers because we got rid of them. There are problems, of course. One is that non-locality. Non-locality in this particular case doesn't seem to be a problem, but if you try to put a gauge theory on the lattice with something non-local, then it's non-trivial. Also, the lattice has to be infinite because otherwise you can't have the sign conservation law. And the last point is that so far we only managed to make this thing consistent for Minkowski metric, but we are working on the Euclidean metric, and so it's we don't know yet whether it's there is some deep difficulty or not. And this is my personal conclusion. I don't know if you can agree with the first statement, but in that case for supersymmetry, maybe we can just begin to understand something. Okay, that's all.
Okay, is there any question?
How can you check the supersymmetric word identities in this theory since it's non-local?
Sorry?
How can you check the supersymmetric word identities in this theory once you said it's non-local? How do you do it?
So, since the theory is non-local, how did you check the word identities?
You work all the time in momentum space, so you just start with some correlation function in momentum space, do supersymmetry transformations, and derive word identities. You don't touch the coordinate space in this.
Okay, if there are no other questions, we thank the speaker again. So,
leave it for a moment.
Can you manage?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, next speaker is Antoine van Pruyen, and he's going to talk about the structure of supergravity.
Okay. Well, I'm very happy to be able to contribute to this festivity for Ricardo Darias' birthday, with the talk on the structure of supergravity. And as you will see, Ricardo has contributed a lot to this, as you will see during the talk, that several things come back of his work. Let me start with simple things that about supersymmetry transforming bosons to fermions and automatically leading to derivatives in the transformation laws. And these derivatives have as effect that in the commutator there are general coordinate transformations. And so once people realized this in the 70s, when the successes had just come about gauging SU2, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 and getting two Nobel Prizes in this way, everyone thought we just have to gauge this, it will give supergravity and we will get a Nobel Prize. So that's what these people did. Some parts are still missing, but that was the status in 76.
If everybody thought that, you should write everybody there as a reference.
So it has developed at the end to a main tool in superstring theory. After this philosophy of the 70s, now supergravity is not seen as a fundamental theory, but as a basic tool to exploit the applications of superstring theory. And so my plan will be, after some historical introduction, to give a catalogue of what supergravity theories are all available, what are the symmetries in supergravity theories, and then come to what we call deformations, also the gauge supergravities, and a little bit about the embedding tensor, about the structure of the actions, and my last part is a bit flexible, depending on how time evolves, about the geometry of supergravity. So in the first year, or the first ideas, is supergravity was introduced as a possible solution to quantum gravity, and also with the idea of unification. So there was research to look for more couplings with phenomenological models. One looked for more symmetries, and thinking about the Kaluza-Klein idea, starting from 11 dimensions, and then getting to n equal 8 in 4 dimensions, but it turned out that the gauge group was not big enough, although there were some partial successes, and there is a paper of how to get SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 from 11 dimensions, in which Ricardo was part. The quantum behavior and the renormalizability were certainly improved by going to supersymmetry and supergravity, but the problem was not solved. Meanwhile, the research got more and more insight in the structure by constructing more theories, gauge supergravity theories, and looking also at the group structure and at geometrical formulations of supergravity, also here in Torino. So in the 80s, however, Green and Schwarz spoiled the fun at a certain point by bringing superstring theory again to as the main tool. And in fact, it was in that year that I came to Torino to work with Ricardo Daria, and who invited me together with Pietro Frey. And we thought of continuing about understanding, well, I would like to understand at that time the group manifold approach their way and combining it with my knowledge. However, everyone got interested in other things in 1984. Because superstring theories gave finite theories and seemed to be useful for unification using the ideas of heterotic strings and Calabi-Yau compactifications. And the research in supergravity cooled down. However, of course, in superstring theory, there is a supergravity limit, because if you go to small string lengths, in fact, where phenomenologically is very interesting, superstring theories at the end become a sort of supergravity theory in any case. But what was seen is that superstring theory that only the supergravity theories in 10 dimensions, and also in the beginning it was a question how we get back to gauge supergravities. The supergravities that were studied at that time were all the ungauged supergravities. But starting from 87, the membranes also came more and more in the game, also thanks to the work of, for instance, Michael Duff. And 11 dimensions came back into the picture, and also due to and in with membranes, also some revival of supergravity started already at that time. Early 90s, with black hole solutions were studied, as well as supergravity theories, its picture as composed of string states relating to Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And so this was another entry point back to supergravities, also because Hull and Townsend found then very many relations between string theories and symmetries of supergravity theories. And Witten has completed the picture with his idea of M-theory relating again to D equal 11 supergravity. So this was the revival became more and more intense. Certainly in 97 with the ADS-CFT coming up, so the dualities between anti-de Sitter and conformal field theory, where field theory was considered as, or is considered as being dual to supergravity solutions. So that led to a lot of interest in all supergravities and their different solutions, which in the late 90s, came back into the picture. So this ADST and ADS-CFT duality ideas continued clearly up to present day, developing further to models also, first of all, with quark-gluon plasma and non-perturbative QCD. These days there are many more of these applications coming up. So in general, these ideas are always based on dualities with supergravity solutions. So it's first of all important to know the different supergravities and to classify what are the possibilities. Also for phenomenological models that are based on compactifications on Calabi-Yau manifolds. Also the last 10 years since 2000, many cosmological solution models are built based on supergravity ideas. And also these became more important thanks to experiments with the cosmic microwave background. These models they say they are based on string theory, but what they effectively use is always the supergravity limit of string theory. So often the supergravity research is string-inspired, even today, not all supergravity theories are related to string theories, as far as I know. Supergravity also has other solutions that became interesting, like cosmic strings, domain walls, Randall syndrome scenarios in cosmology. So many of these are important in these days. So that brings me to second part of my talk about what are all the different supergravity theories. And to understand them, one first needs some basic knowledge on spinors in any dimension. And the important table is the one that I show here that says what is the minimal spinor for a specific space-time dimension. The table is here for Minkowski signature. And it mentions Majorana spinors, Majorana wild spinors, symplectic spinors, symplectic wild spinors. I'm not going to the details of their definition. But the important numbers here is the minimal number of supersymmetry charges in these different dimensions. And that's in fact the basis to come to the next table that shows what are the possible extensions of supergravity in a certain dimension that is shown here with the number of supersymmetries that is shown on the top. Due to limits that we have for the moment on field representations, we can only find field theories up to 32 supersymmetries. And so this is the left-hand side of the table. The lower end is in four dimensions, just because of the problems that the screen is too small. If I had to go to lower dimensions, it would become much bigger. But so I restricted myself here to four and higher dimensions. And so the lower end in four dimensions, a basic spinner has at least four components. And so that's where the n equal one theory in four dimensions comes in. And then, there can be many things I can say about this table, but I'm going to leave it here as a general picture of what sort of basic theories that exist. That means what is shown here is what are the different possible extensions of supersymmetry with a certain dimension. With several of these theories, a matter can be added in vector multiplets, tensor multiplets, or things like hypermultiplets or chiral multiplets in low extensions. So these add extra ingredients to these sort of theories of what are the different particles that play a role. I mentioned, I put it, this scheme is organized here that theories that are for the just based on their kinetic term, independent, are written here. For instance, tensor multiplets can also be defined in lower dimensions, but as far as we have it, as we talk only about the kinetic terms, they are equivalent to theories without tensor multiplets. But as I will repeat later, if you talk about gauge supergravities, that's already not anymore true. So, gauge supergravities, it's in the idea of the distinction that I make between what is a basic supergravity theory and what is a deformation. Basic supergravities have only gauged supersymmetry, otherwise it's not supergravity, and general coordinate transformations to have gravity. And if you like, the U1s of abelian vector fields. There is no potential for the scalars, and there are only Minkowski vacua. So, but in any entry of the previous table, there are deformations. That means without changing the kinetic terms of the fields, the couplings between the fields are changed. Many of these deformations can be seen as gauged supergravity. That means you gauge a Young-Mills group, and that will introduce a potential which in the string theory picture can be produced by fluxes on brains. There are also other deformations that we are not yet sure of whether it can also be obtained as gauge supergravities, like massive deformations, and for instance the superpotential in n equal 1 in four dimensions is an example of some other deformation that is, so as far as we understand it today at least, not based on gauging of a symmetry. So, remark one thing that I already mentioned a bit. Sometimes other field representations can give more insight rather than just the chiral multiplets that were in the table. For instance, in four dimensions, tensor multiplets. There were various papers in 2004 by this group of people that explained how some of these theories can be better understood by tensor multiplets or in five dimensions, for instance, deformations can only be obtained by adding tensor multiplets in some cases. Questions that remain is that whether all deformations can be obtained by enlarging the gauge group, because some of the deformations that you would think are not can sometimes be done by adding extra symmetries that are afterwards broken. It's certainly not known at present how to do this for all deformations, but I don't exclude that in the future such an insight can be gained. Also, the E11 approach, that means these infinite symmetries that are present in supergravity theories, may be able to classify all deformations. That's another approach. I will not say much more about that in this talk. So, symmetries. So the basic algebraic ingredient is that the commutator of two supersymmetries gives translations, or if caged, general coordinate transformations. But there is much more. There are all sorts of symmetries that can act on the fields. And to be clear about what we are talking, I have to distinguish between global symmetries, local symmetries. Yeah? Global symmetries being the parameters that are not space-time dependent, local symmetries are, or gauge symmetries, parameters that are space-time dependent. But further, there are other distinctions that are important. Sometimes we talk about symmetries of the action. In other cases, one talks about symmetries of field equations, and sometimes one talks about symmetries of solutions. Any symmetry of the action gives a symmetry between field equations. But the reverse is certainly not true. Some symmetries of field equations are not yet symmetries of the action, so there are more symmetries of field equations. Solutions do not respect all these symmetries, they break certain of the symmetries of the field equations. And it's also important to remark that when people talk about symmetries of the solutions, they are not anymore talking about the local symmetries, but these parameters are split into parts that are global again. So that's when people, for instance, say one half of supersymmetry is broken, they mean that from the infinite number of symmetries in the beginning, if you reduce them to a finite number, global symmetries, then one half is broken. So this is also an important part thing to understand. There are also other type of symmetries, like symmetries that act on the parameters that determine which action you are looking at, like sigma model symmetries. For instance, changing the Kähler potential is an example. So Kähler transformations is an example of these extra symmetries. R-symmetry groups is another important aspect. It are the symmetries that rotate the different supersymmetries, so that connect one supersymmetry to another, so that do not commute with supersymmetry, but at the right-hand side there is another linear combination of the supersymmetries. In a way, rotation symmetries are already like that, Lorentz transformations, but we talk here about the other ones apart from Lorentz transformations. And it's easy to do a group theoretic analysis based again on the properties of these of the spinors in different dimensions, to see that the R symmetries respect or define a group that depends on these properties of these spinors. For instance, in four dimensions, we will be left with UN groups in general, but in other dimensions, it are maybe USPN groups or SON groups, so that is dependent on the dimension. Other extra things of symmetries are central charges. That means that the right-hand side of two of the anti-commutator between supersymmetries does not only have translations, but has extra parts. For instance, in four dimensions, n equal 2, there are these two extra central charges, which then commute with all the rest. But the concept has been extended to other examples where, in fact, mathematically speaking, these right-hand sides are not really central because they have Lorentz indices, so they don't commute with the Lorentz group. But for physics, they serve the same role, and therefore they are often also called central charges. Why are they important? Because with such with the algebra, there are already limits on what are physical solutions of the field equations of supergravities. In fact, due to the reality properties of the supercharges, the left-hand side can be written as something like QQ dagger, and hence on Hilbert space gives a positive quantity, so the right-hand side should also be positive. And without central charges, any solution that has preserved supersymmetry leads in this way to a zero mass state, because you can put the particle at rest, and then P0 gives the mass, and so you get only mass zero objects. So with central charges, on the other hand, there is typically a bound that the mass has to be at least equal to central charge or the square, or it depends a bit how you define it. So, and this is called a BPS bound, and states that saturate this bound are called BPS states. They often arise in supergravity from the concept of soft algebras and algebras of solution. So, first of all, in rigid symmetries, there is a Lie algebra, which means that the parameters that appear in the right-hand side of commutation relations are parameters that are combinations of the parameters from which one starts at the left-hand side with structure constants. But when local symmetries are involved, these Fs are often functions of the fields, and that is the concept that is called a soft algebra. So not rigid constants anymore, but functions that may depend from point to point, depending on values of the fields in these different points. And this is a general feature of theories with supersymmetry and local symmetries. And for instance, in 11 dimensions, the supergravity commutator gives at the right-hand side a combination of a lot of the symmetries of supergravity, like Lorentz transformations, supersymmetries, and gauge transformations of three-index field, that the gauge transformations have two indices. And these parameters depend on fields that are in the supergravity. But then if you look to a solution with fixed fields, these structure functions become again constants if the fields are shifted. And that gives at the right-hand side a non-zero result, and different Lie algebras may result than the one that you were originally looking at. And so in this way, the rigid algebra of solutions may have central charges. So they result from making the soft algebra again rigid when going to solutions. About the deformations, a basic supergravity theory can have very different gaugings. The first example, n equal 8, what Cremer and Julien originally constructed was the pure n equal 8 ungauged basic supergravity. There were 28 factors, but they were abelian, so you can say they have a U1 to the 28 gauge group. There is no potential. De Witt Nicolai first introduced vectors that gauge SO8, and this generate a potential, and one talks about gauge supergravity in that case. And later also many other possible SOPQR gaugings were introduced. I'm not going to explain what it all means. Here just the concept that many different versions exist of this supergravity theory, as first pointed out by Hull, but in 10 years later, there were different papers that made more order into the story, and I mention here several of the contributors that are, in fact, here present today. So the question is, what are the most general possibilities? And so, but to study this, I have to say still a bit more about gauge symmetries. And first, I want to do a warning always with terminology. When one talks about global ungauged supersymmetry, it means that one has a super Poincaré group, but it's not gauged. Gauged supersymmetry means that vectors that are in matter multiplets of the global supersymmetry can gauge a Young-Mills group. And this gauge group commutes with the supersymmetry generators, but it can often appear in the right-hand side of the commutators of two supersymmetries with the concept of a soft algebra already. supergravity non-gauged means that you have a gauged super Poincaré group, but there are no other gauged symmetries. While gauged supergravity means that vector fields gauge also an extra Young-Mills group. And now the story also changes a bit because this gauge group in general does not commute with the supersymmetry and acts always partly as R symmetries on the supersymmetries. And these symmetries appear also again in the commutator of two supersymmetry generators. So some remarks, the number of generators is always equal to the number of vectors. And this may include as well the vectors that are in supergravity multiplet as those that are in vector multiplets, because with the non-linearity of the couplings of supergravity, they cannot anymore be distinguished. Gauge symmetries are generally part of the isometries of the scalar manifold, so of the manifold defined by the kinetic terms of the scalars. And one has to identify which part of the isometry group is gauged, and that is done by the concept of embedding tensor. So the gauge group is a subgroup of the isometry group. And so if you have here all the rigid symmetries acting on the fields, one has to make linear combinations of them that are coupled to the gauge field. And this is the concept of the embedding tensor. So it determines which symmetries are gauged and also which weight is given to them. For instance, coupling constants can be considered as the first trivial example of an embedding tensor. In order that all this is consistent, there are several constraints on the tensor, and that has been looked at these started with these papers that I mentioned here below. Certainly, more research is necessary to know all the supergravities, even restricting to those that have at most two space-time derivatives in the action. Yeah.
Or n equal 2 with the cosmological, you can have also gauge supergravities where there are no where the scalars just are not there.
Sure.
So it's not really true that you are gauging isometries of the scalar manifold, in the sense that you can have theories where there is no scalar manifold.
These are all rigid symmetries, and when there are scalars, these rigid symmetries are determined by the isometries. For the case there are no scalars, these are sometimes determined by symmetries like also in four dimensions, by symplectic symmetries that is present in the couplings of vectors. And so it's not always determined by the isometries. That's correct, yeah.
Supergravity.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote it.
So to discuss the actions, there are many possible constructions. The first constructions is an order-by-order neuter transformations, and which is in fact the only possibilities if you have supersymmetries with very high extensions. Superspace is a construction method that is very useful for rigid n equal 1 theories because it shows the structure of multiplets, but it becomes very difficult for supergravity because it needs many fields and many gauge transformations. Supergroup manifold approach has been developed, in fact, here by Riccardo Daria, Pietro Freire, Tullio Regge. It has been mentioned before already today. It's the optimal use of symmetries using constraints on curvatures. And as I mentioned before, I, at a certain point, would have liked to learn more about it. What I'm using mostly is superconformal tensor calculus, which keeps the structure of multiplets as in superspace, but it avoids the immense number of extra fields that you need and extra gauge transformations, while it still keeps the possibility to get a better insight in the structure of the theories. But there are restrictions. It can only be done when there are matter multiplets present, So, for instance, with supersymmetry extensions, up to 16 supercharges. A full action looks something like this, and you see it's very complicated, and it has very different things like four fermion interactions, interaction between gauge fields and fermions, terms that looks like masses for fermions, and so on. But the main structure is in fact in the leading terms, which for instance for four dimensions is always a combination of all the sort of kinetic terms for spin 2 fields, spin 1 fields, spin 0 fields, spin 3 half fields, spin 1 half fields, and a certain potential. And there are some general properties, like for instance the potential can be obtained from transformation laws of the fermionic fields, some quadratic relations between this. So the potential has a general typically structure in supersymmetric theories as being the square of the transformations of the fermions, where you have to take this square using a certain metric, the metric that is determined by the kinetic terms of the fermions. This has been found many years ago, 85, but I want to draw here an attention to a paper of Ricardo's together with Sergio, which is not very well known, but which I like a lot, which gives in a very simple way how you can find these relations between the transformations of fermions and different parts of the actions just by some word identities. So if we come to the scalar manifold, there are some isometries. That means they are symmetries of the kinetic energies of the scalars. These symmetries are nearly always extended to symmetries of the full basic supergravity action, and this is often called the U-duality group. A subgroup of this isometry group can be gauged using the concept that I mentioned below, before being the embedding tensor. So I come now to the part on geometry and supergravity. So geometry being determined by the kinetic terms of the Lagrangian for the scalar fields. The coefficients determine a metric on the space of configurations of these scalar fields. That is how the geometry is defined. This leads to scalar manifolds, and for theories with more than 8 component supersymmetries, real superchargers, all these manifolds turn out to be symmetric spaces. That means G over H, where with some extra properties that the commutators of two coset elements gives again an element of H. Okay, well, scalar manifold with 4 supersymmetries, so n equal 1 in 4 dimensions, but you can also obtain it for lower dimensions, are Kähler manifolds. Essential property there is the existence of a complex structure. Scalar theories, manifolds for theories with 8 supersymmetries are called special manifolds, and they include various type of manifolds, real manifolds, sometimes special Kähler manifolds, also quaternionic manifolds, and they can be sometimes symmetric spaces, sometimes less, but still homogeneous spaces, or not even that, that there are even sometimes no extra isometries or symmetries. So when I say all symmetric spaces, here is a table of this, and you see certain properties always that in the denominator, there appears this R symmetry group. So this is a general properties of these cosets, of these manifolds. Here there are extra parts when there are extra vector multiplets present, so this is the appearance of this extra ON, but apart from these parts that depend on matter manifold, you find again the R symmetry group always in the denominator. In 8 supersymmetries, So as I mentioned, very special manifolds or special Kähler manifolds or quaternionic manifolds. So in different dimensions, it's a bit different. You always have a quaternionic manifold, but then you have some other very special real or special Kähler manifolds. In each case, there is you find the R-symmetry group in the isotropy group of the manifold. And so for four supersymmetries, U1 is always part of this isotropy group. I see with the time as it goes that I'm not going to go much more into this, and I'm going to skip to more conclusions here at this point. As I mentioned before, I was not sure how far I would get here. So let me get to the final remarks. We know a lot about the general structure of supergravity theories. And Ricardo contributed a lot to this insight of all the supergravity theories and their symmetry structure, with, for instance, investigations on dualities, on geometry, on relations with string theory. And presently, for instance, black hole solutions are studied a lot, and Ricardo contributes again to uncover the general structure related to dualities. There are a lot of applications of supergravity, and especially all the relations that are often mentioned between strings and high-energy experiments, or strings cosmology, or strings solid-state physics, always need the step of supergravity to understand really the visible aspects of the theory. I want to finish with looking again at this table, and my idea was to indicate now on this table where Ricardo had contributed, but when I started, it turned out that I could only fill the whole table, and Ricardo has really contributed to nearly the whole story of this. Someone put something strange on this picture, which I would rather change in supergravity, so I hope that with supergravity, Ricardo, or without supergravity, if he likes, can still have a very healthy life and some further years that he enjoys. Thanks.
Is there any question? Okay, if there are no other questions, we thank the speaker again. So let me remind you that now there's going to be a small refreshment served here in this room, an aperitif, okay? And for those of you who are interested in attending the concert, it will take place in Aula Magna, which is right above this room, okay? And although it will start at 6:30, you're strongly advised to be there by 6:20, the latest, okay? To attend it, you need to have a ticket. And you can get the ticket from Laura Andrianopoli, who should be around here. That's all. Thank you.
I missed some citations to you because I couldn't finish the talk. There were several parts which are coming with special geometry. With special geometry also, I wanted to write more about you. There are several contributions to special geometry that I couldn't mention.
I think there was I'm not sure the word is for expert, not for the public. I'm not sure you're italiano,
perché? Sì, va bene.
Tu hai detto che c'è un 1 nell'isotropy group. Non è vero. Ma no, scusa, isotropy significa quando mente asimmetri, olonomi è, non isotropi. Ma perché un Kähler manifold può anche essere non simmetrico. Isotropy è quando si parla di H, giusto H.
Uh-huh.
sul Keller Manifold può avere no isometrie e si la U1.
Ah sì, quando non ci sono isometrie e allora mica. Sì, sì, sì.
Ovviamente se ci sono, se il gruppo, se il spazio è giusto H, è un 1 nel risultato del gruppo.